Hello there, and welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia, Series 1, The Cambodian Nightmare. My name is Lachlan Peters, and if you're new to the show, well, the podcast is a holistic explanation of the Khmer Rouge Revolution in Cambodia. How it happened, what happened, and why. These questions require placing that revolution within the wider context of Cambodian history, and how that history relates to the world as well. This explanation has thus far taken us from the earliest periods of Khmer history through to the heights and functions of their mighty empire, and is now settling down into a protracted low point following a transformation of the Khmer civilization that occurred from around the 15th century. This era we are speaking about, which used to be called the Dark Ages of Cambodia, requires a lot of explanation, and this episode can be seen to overlap with the time frame as well as the themes of the last episode, Becoming Cambodia. I've always thought of what happened to Cambodia in the 1970s as similar to the formation of a huge storm system. Or if I wanted to be slightly more scientifically accurate with my rudimentary meteorology, a better fit would be, I guess, how a tornado forms. Don't, you know, quote me on this, but if I understand the basics of these storms, they form when cool, dry air systems collide with warm, moist air, and they create an atmospheric tension that will swirl together until it forms an extremely destructive funnel of wind, tornado. So if we take that kind of concept, where it relies on two different processes colliding in the right conditions to create something different, something awful, something deadly, well, the Khmer Rouge Revolution kind of mirrors this, in that we have the warm, moist air pressure system of, you know, the themes and historical context of Cambodian history. For example, the weakened state of the country in the 20th century. And this ends up colliding with the dry, cold air that is the bigger global historical themes like globalization, colonialism, and then eventually the Cold War and communism. And these two storm systems or pressure systems, they collide in just the right way and in just the right time to come together and end up creating this storm that will utterly destroy millions of lives. Both parts on their own might have caused a storm, but together they led to something else, something more akin to a complete disaster. So far in this podcast, we've mainly been focusing on the warm, tropical part of the storm. Cambodia, its history, its relationship with its neighbours, particularly Vietnam. And that's crucial for how the story progresses. But now we need to turn our attention to the other part of the storm. The cold, dry air coming from over the seas, places like Europe and eventually the United States. This episode will continue our explanation of Cambodia between the Angkor era and modern Cambodia. And in doing so, we're going to introduce the European parts of this story as Cambodia transitions from a regional superpower in Southeast Asia, one that controlled most of, you know, the land in between, you know, Burma and, you know, Vietnam. They're going to transform from that superpower to a minor colonial asset for a country that's on the other side of the planet. So, a brief outline for this episode, Becoming Cambodia Part 2. Well, we're going to talk about Europe and colonialism, what this process looked like, and how Cambodia was first introduced to it back in the 1500s. It isn't the primary focus, but we have to start laying the groundwork here so it won't just come out of nowhere in the next episode. We will be going back over a similar time period that we covered in the last episode, but instead of focusing on just what was happening in Indochina, we're going to look at what Europeans were doing there and what the consequences of European influence in the region will be. By the end of this episode, we will go back and cover how Vietnam was unified after a period of civil war in the late 1700s, and what this meant for the weakened Khmer civilization. And as we do this, we're going to look at how the story becomes set up for the distinct influence of French colonialism in the modern era. We are getting closer and closer to the actual lifespans of the people who will bring the Cambodian nightmare into reality. And it is in this period that we see the settings and influences on their lives falling into place. In the last episode, we spoke about Cambodia's transition from the vast Khmer Empire into a more constrained and less powerful territory. We also touched on some of the factors that influenced this transition, moving the capital from Angkor to Phnom Penh due to, repeated invasions from Cambodia's new rival in the west, the Kingdom of Siam, or Thailand. And I will interchange those terms throughout the episode, so keep that in mind. Now, these invasions from the West also coincided with an economic change for the Khmer, where a society that had been based more or less completely on rice production and taxation turned toward becoming more of a trade-based kingdom that could take advantage of the Mekong River's connection with the South China Sea, and this shift in focus may have worked out for the Khmer Empire in the long run, if they had managed to keep control of the territories of their kingdom that were required to support this trading state that they had set up. We discussed how a major Thai invasion in 1594 marked a point on the historical map after which the Khmer Kingdom was seriously weakened, where its politics became increasingly influenced by either Siam or the steadily growing proto-Vietnamese states in the east. I began explaining Vietnamese history and the different cultural foundations which can be seen to divide the Vietnamese apart from the Khmer and the Siamese, whose cultures grew more from similar roots. So the easiest way of explaining that would be to say that Vietnam was more influenced from Chinese culture, while Siamese and Khmer culture came more or less from Indian cultural foundations. So if I was going to wrap up the last episode, in a nutshell, it would be like Cambodia was very much a big dog, but due to a few different factors, it could no longer maintain this big dog status. Over about 500 years or so, Cambodia shrunk significantly, while its neighbours grew and began controlling formerly Khmer territories. Significantly, Siam and Vietnam took over regions that connected Cambodia to outside trade, such as the western coast, as well as the Mekong Delta, which was an important and highly populated area known as Kampuchea Krom. Those of you who have been to the infamous Tuol Sleng prison in Phnom Penh may remember Kampuchea Krom mentioned in some of the rules that the prisoners who were being tortured there had to follow. So you can kind of see that that loss of this region, it's not going to be easily forgotten. In this transformative period, the Cambodian royal family and the cult of the Devaraja became less influential and was marred by infighting and power struggles. By the 18th and 19th century, Cambodian politics became more or less a game of either playing up to one or the other of these more powerful neighbours in manoeuvres that were aimed at holding on to vestiges of independence for the once powerful empire. You might remember the situation being likened somewhat patronizingly by a Vietnamese emperor as Cambodia being able to run to its mother when its father is being mean, and likewise being able to run to its father when upset with its mother. So, the impression that I was trying to impart on you in that episode was basically that it is not going great for the Khmer in the post-Angkor era. And having hopefully been able to colour your perceptions of that period in, as well as introduce some of the animosity that the Khmer felt as a result of this newfound inferiority, I want to quickly run through this middle period once more in regards to what Europeans are doing in Southeast Asia at this time, before returning to Vietnam and discussing how a long period of civil war came to an end at the beginning of the 19th century. This should give us a brief introduction to the history of colonialism in general before we try and explain what it would look like on the Southeast Asian mainland. You might remember from the last episode a brief discussion of the short-lived capital of Cambodia, known as Lo Vek. This city, which was located between the Tonle Sap, remember it's the Great Lake of Cambodia, it was located between the Tonle Sap and Phnom Penh. And it was, by all accounts, a very nice city, while it remained the capital for around 50 years, until it was conquered by the Thai in 1594. The reason I want to go back in time and revisit this city again in this episode is so that we can have a little reintroduction of Europeans into this story from events that transpire within Cambodia. So this city, Lo Vek or Long Vek, became the capital during one of the last periods of Khmer prosperity after the Angkor era, built by King Ang Chan and maintained less successfully by his successors. The city had a multitude of foreign traders living there. There were all these kinds of separate quarters within the city. So you'd have the Dutch quarter or the Chinese quarter, and they would trade amongst themselves and with each other. Among them were a couple of adventurers, one from Spain and one from Portugal. They were named Blas Ruiz de Hernan Gonzalez and Diogo Veloso. Now, I'm not sure about what you guys think, but when you throw out a word like adventure or adventurers in a modern context, I feel like most people are going to be thinking about fictional characters. Like for me, a classic adventurer is the hero from the Legend of Zelda series, Link. This virtuous young boy is usually tasked with going on a grand journey of discovery, while also saving a princess, defeating a monstrous villain along the way. Now, apart from a few holidays, or maybe an unexpected turn on a long walk, no one really says, "Yeah, I went on an adventure" anymore. You know, no one's really has adventurer on their resume. Well, 500 years ago, you definitely could be an adventurer, and these two guys, well, if they had resumes, they would have had adventurer on it. It would have been right up the top. Name, date of birth, occupation, adventurer. And they really were doing things that stack up against fictional adventures. Unfortunately, though, I mean, these guys, I don't know, they weren't heroes as well as being adventurers. So what I'm going to do is just gloss over the story of Blas Ruiz and Veloso just to give you an impression of some European attitudes during this so-called Age of Discovery. Because soon enough, that Age of Discovery will turn into the Age of Imperialism. But certain themes will remain consistent whether it's 1600 or 1900. Themes that will help us to understand how the modern world will be shaped in large part by European conquest. So we did touch on this in the last episode, but around the 15th century, we start seeing powerful empires spread out from Europe and around the globe for the first time in history, really, utilizing advancements in navigation, mapping, and maritime technology. Kingdoms such as Portugal and Spain became early adopters of this process and set up territories across the seas in North and South America, Africa, and regions of Asia. It is not long after this initial age of discovery where, you know, European people are just discovering things, even though people were already there and living their lives, that we see infamous examples of what this spread of Europe would mean to these so-called discovered people, such as Hernan Cortes leading an expedition that would cause the fall of the Aztec Empire, or the horrors of the Atlantic slave trade, which was set up to some extent in order to afford labor to these new colonies that were being founded. This process also introduced diseases such as smallpox that would sometimes destroy entire native populations. Spain and Portugal really set the precedent for this new age, and these kingdoms gain extremely large amounts of wealth by essentially plundering these newfound lands, basically just taking their gold and silver. Obviously, I am oversimplifying this, but it can be boiled down to what essentially looks like someone coming from a technologically more advanced society with ships and guns and cannons and demanding servitude and gold and saying something along the lines of, "This land is actually our land now." Now, something that gets a little tricky here is the justification of the colonizers for doing this. Naturally, you could rationalize this process in a couple of ways. The first being a kind of might is right sort of dynamic, whereby simply being more powerful than those you conquer means that you had the right to conquer them. And producing wealth for your kingdom and empire, well, that's the reason you're going to do this. The second aspect to this is clouded by religion. All of these European colonial powers are Catholic or Protestant, meaning the spread of Christianity was also served by the spread of these European empires. This gave a process that could be plainly viewed as the subjugation of native people by people with cannons, with this, in the minds of those colonizing, that is, justification for what they were doing. Like, yeah, sure, I'm conquering this land and I'm taking this gold, but I'm also going to save these poor souls from eternal damnation by giving them the one true religion while I do it. So if you're part of an expedition to some far-off part of Southern America, part of you is excited about the loot you might be able to find and helping your empire grow, a secular benefit, but there's also a spiritual benefit to this process. It's hard to separate the two sides of the coin here, and I'll let you decide on how much you want to believe that those who conquered these lands in the name of Christianity truly had spirituality being a concern, rather than simply gold or glory. But Christianity and the spread of missionaries across the globe along with the colonial powers will be an important aspect of this colonizing process. This early period of colonialism, the one dominated by Portugal and Spain and characterized by the search for gold and silver and the spread of Christianity, we're going to call this Phase 1 of the colonial period. And it will be the most popular method for 100 years or so, until the 16th century, when the Dutch begin establishing lucrative trading posts that show the other European powers that you can actually make more money than simply extracting gold and silver from these lands by instead engaging with the process of moving goods around from place to place and trading these goods. We're going to call that Phase 2. And this is where we see a kind of race for all of these European powers who attempt to establish colonies all around the globe that could produce raw materials for you, for the trading of goods, for profit. But we will get to Phase 2 in a moment. For now, I want to check back in with Cambodia and the capital of Lovech on the eve of a Siamese invasion in 1594, and the events that follow, just to show you how this mix of Christianity and the search for wealth and territory overlapped. So, back in Cambodia, back in a time before the truly low points of the Khmer civilization, there is an invasion coming from Siam, one that would target the capital that was currently situated, as we said, at Lovech. The story that I'm going to retell here is mostly gathered from Lawrence Palmer Briggs in a journal article from 1950. And now I'm going to leave a link to that article in the description if you would like to read into these events in a little more detail than I will provide in the podcast. But anyway, this Siamese invasion is coming. And I want you to put yourself in the royal court of the Cambodian king who is trying to figure out what to do about this incoming Siamese force. The Cambodian ruler at Lovech, King Sata, was not a particularly great king. And he is apparently not powerful enough to stop this invasion from occurring because he is looking abroad for aid to come and help fend off the Siamese. As we've already discussed, this is at a time where this city, Lovech, is quite the little trading hub, and you've got lots of foreigners in there, including Christian missionaries from Portugal, trying to establish their faith in what is a pretty new region for them at the time. They're not having any luck doing this, however. And Briggs says that the Cambodian people were hospitable, but quite indifferent to the exhortations of the Christian missionaries. He says that the Khmer were extremely satisfied being Buddhist, and that the only converts these missionaries had managed were actually from the Japanese and Chinese traders who were also living in Lovech. So you could say that the Khmer were a spiritually tough nut to crack. Anyway, King Sata was quite fond of foreigners, and at his royal court there were many who could just sort of join in and have their say to the king about certain affairs and whatnot. One who had particular favour of the king was a Portuguese named Diogo Veloso. He had been living in Cambodia for almost a decade. He'd even married a relative of the king, so he's fairly ingratiated in the community. Another foreigner who had recently arrived in Cambodia and at Lovech was a young Spaniard named Blas Rui. It is in this period, before the Siamese invasion, that King Sata looked to these foreigners here and he says, okay, I need help fending off this invasion. Maybe I can reach out to one of the newly arrived European powers in the region for help. The Spanish are now in the Philippines, that's not too far away. Maybe I can ask them for help. What I'll do, I'll send my buddy, Diego Veloso, who's been here for ages and, you know, he's married a relative of mine. I know him pretty well. What I'll do, I'll send my buddy to go there to the Philippines and basically broker a deal so we can get some assistance from the Spanish. So King Sata, he sends Veloso out with a small team on a ship to Manila, and he keeps the newly arrived foreigner, Blas Ruiz, the Spaniard, he keeps him close, he keeps him in the court, because, according to Briggs, one look at the stalwart form of Blas Ruiz convinced the faint-hearted king that he wanted him near during the impending trouble with Siam. Which sounds to me as if he was basically saying, okay, I want this big, strong boy here with me when all of this goes down. So that's the situation. We have the Cambodian king, we have two foreigners, one from Spain, one from Portugal. The king has sent the Portuguese foreigner out to Manila to get help, and he keeps the other one with him at the court in case of any trouble. Veloso is sent off to Manila, and he has a letter from the king to plead to the Spanish. Naturally, this letter was written on gold leaf, and on it the king has to basically lay out what he's going to give the Spanish in return for their protection against the Siamese. Included in this letter is the promise that the king would convert to Christianity, which is a pretty big part of this deal. So Veloso gets to Manila and gives the letter to the Spanish governor general there, a man named Dasmarinas. So if we imagine them coming into his office with this deal on gold leaf, Well, they come at a slightly inopportune time, because Daz Marinas, he was actually just about to go out on his own expedition. He needs to subdue some troublesome natives on some of his islands, but he has time to read the deal. He likes what the deal seems to be promising from King Sarta in Cambodia, and he agrees to help. First, he'll have some words with Siam, you know, warn them off. And if that doesn't work, he will provide armed resistance. To seal the deal, he sends back a nice horse and some other presents to the Cambodian king, which was the style at the time. Veloso says something like, "That's great, we're going to stay here in Manila until you get back from your errands, and then we'll go help my buddy King Sarta." Well, a few days later, on Governor Dasmarina's expedition, the Chinese crew of his ship decide to kill him, and they steal his stuff and his boat, and then they sail off to the coast of Vietnam, which at the time is a real haven of scum and villainy. It's the Mos Eisley of Southeast Asia at that point in time. After this turn of events, Veloso basically just asks the next guy in charge if he will help. It turns out the next guy in charge was the Governor General's son, and he seems to be on board with the plan too. So after this minor setback, they wait until the new guy agrees to the same deal, and then they decide it's time to head back to Cambodia, back to Lovech, to let everyone know that the Spanish have agreed to help if the Siamese invade. Mission accomplished. Well, back in the day, communication wasn't quite as fast, and it was a little harder to keep abreast of everything going on. And by the time Veloso gets back to Lovech, well, it's already been conquered by the Siamese. It turns out that before the invasion, the king had fled east to Phnom Penh with a couple of his younger sons, but he had left an older prince at Lovech. His name was Soryapor. Now, that prince's job was to defend it against the Siamese attack. And in the last episode, we actually discussed the battle itself. You know, it had war elephants, cannons, Europeans fighting. You know, everyone's trying to help out, but the walls come down and the Siamese take something like 100,000 prisoners back to Siam. It's important to note that one of the prisoners taken back alive was actually the prince named Soryapor, the son that King Sarta had left in charge. Put a pin in that. Anyway, since he's been gone, Veloso, there has been some fairly big changes. When he gets back to Lovech with what he, you know, he thought was good news, he's basically got the letter in his hand saying, "Yeah, we'll protect you from the Siamese." Diego Veloso is quickly taken prisoner by all the Siamese that are at Lovech, and he's sent by ship to their Thai capital, Ayutthaya. Meanwhile, in Phnom Penh, King Sarta, he's not having a good time. First of all, his plan didn't go very well. Lovech was conquered, he's promised to convert to Christianity if he can get some support from Europeans, but that hasn't come in time, and to top it off, one of his relatives, a man named Rama, he has got together some support from a Chinese enclave in Phnom Penh, as well as with some Chams and Malays. Remember, the Chams were the guys who were defeated by the Vietnamese and had converted to Islam a few centuries ago. He gets this little cabal together, and he takes over in Phnom Penh. This is the kind of stuff that was running rampant in Cambodia's royal families for ages. And here we have another prime example where, basically, if you have an opportunity to become king, you should get some friends together to support you and you should go for it. Rama succeeds, and, sensing he might be a little unwelcome in this new royal scenario, the former King Sarta says, "All right, I'm going to have to get out of here as well." And he flees once again, this time to a whole nother kingdom. He goes north to Laos with a couple of his kids. Rama, having taken the throne in Phnom Penh, actually gets a little bit of luck, because it turns out that the Siamese occupation of Lovech to the west, you know, the whole thing that kicked this off, well, they've recently been considerably weakened by a Burmese invasion of their home country. So they have to fend off that, and in doing so, they leave the territory they'd just taken over in Cambodia, and now it's open to a counterattack from the new Khmer king. So he takes back Levesque. It's looking okay for the new ruler, Rama, and it could be that the Khmer are back on stable ground. They've got their city back, the Siamese are distracted by the Burmese, they've got a new king, maybe everything's going to be okay. Maybe. If you remember the other Spanish adventurer in this story, Bla Ruiz, the strong boy that King Sata had wanted around. Well, what's he doing right now? He had decided to head to Manila before Sata had been removed from power by Rama. So he still thinks Sata is ruling in Phnom Penh. Meanwhile, and in what can only be described as some old school adventurer shenanigans, the other guy, Diego Veloso, the one that had gone to Manila originally to get the deal, the one that had been sent back to Siam as a prisoner, well, he's managed to stage a little escape from his shackles and kill his prison guards who were taking him back to their capital. He then commandeers the ship and he turns it around to the Philippines in a fairly dramatic scene on the high seas. Both of these adventurers end up arriving in Manila around the same time. And once they meet up, they decide to hatch a plan to get their buddy, King Sata, back in control of Cambodia. Which is, you know, wild. And little do they know, their king isn't even king anymore, and the Khmer are in control at this time anyway. This is the part of the story that I find really fascinating, because it really seems incredible that two guys, you know, would have the gall to just kind of take it upon themselves to restore a monarch to power in a foreign country. How does someone even start figuring out how to do that? Naturally, they may have been highly motivated. I mean, you'd assume you'd be handsomely rewarded by a person if you do them the fairly solid favor of making them the king of an entire country again. But it just kind of boggles my mind that this was a thing that could happen during this bit of history. Anyway, the plan that Veloso and Ruiz get together is a little bit like the old plan. They would talk to the Spanish governor again, promise a bunch of stuff, and see if they could get some support together that they could then bring back to Cambodia and help their buddy Sata, who, again, they both still think is in power in Phnom Penh, and they'll be able to help him wrestle control of the entire country back, because they are still under the impression that the Siamese have control of Levesque. Just as a little side note here, and to remind you that this story is also aimed at highlighting some of the strange ways that Christianity was entwined with colonialism at this point, I just want to give you an impression of what the two adventurers are going to promise the Spanish governor in order to get support for their plan. So there is a very long list of rules that the Cambodian king is going to have to abide by if the Spanish come and help. And here are just a few. First, the king of Cambodia and his wife and household must be baptized. He must also permit Christianity to be preached freely and must assist by building churches and by granting protection to Christians. Remember, this is a religion that until this point just couldn't get a foothold on the Khmer population. So they're basically cramming it down their throats in this deal. What else? So the Spanish must be given a port in Cambodia, as well as a good site for settlement and fortifications of this settlement. The king must also help maintain that settlement. The king must also swear that no false doctrine shall be preached or practiced. Again, you can pretty easily see this being turned into literally no other faith but Christianity can be allowed to exist in your country now. That's the reading in between the lines of this deal. Oh, and also the Spanish must be consulted when naming successors to the throne from now on. Yeah, no biggie. So this is all pretty extreme. And it's fairly easy to see how Christianity was almost used as a wedge to get basic foreign power structures in place in these new world lands and kingdoms. It strikes me as similar to what is often called soft power in modern international relations. Soft power being a persuasive use of things like economic influence to broker alliances or treaties. So instead of a country using hard power and just invading another country and making them do what you want at gunpoint, you might set up some kind of economic deal between two nations, which may have the same intended outcomes of that country doing what you want, but with money rather than with guns. So in this sense, you could see the Spanish are setting up a religious deal with Cambodia rather than simply an economic one. Anyway, back in Manila, Diego Veloso is also in the governor's ear. He's telling him wonderful tales about how fertile the soil is in Cambodia and how it has all these rich mines of gold and silver. It doesn't, by the way. And about how much wealth could be gained from getting control of this region, not to mention all of the glory that would also come his way by converting the Cambodian king and his subjects to Christianity. It's a win-win, right? Okay, so having convinced the people they needed to convince, Veloso and Ruiz are given a battle-ready ship and 130 soldiers. They set sail back to Cambodia and head toward Phnom Penh along the Mekong River. When they get there, the first thing they notice is that King Sata is long gone, and they're told that he had actually fled to Laos. The king that had replaced him, Rama, he gets word that the foreigners are in Phnom Penh, and he gets a message back to them saying, "It's all good, don't worry, I'm going to come to Phnom Penh and I'm going to explain to you what's happened, just wait there." Upon hearing this, however, well, our little group of would-be kingmakers, they're upset and a little bit suspicious of what might happen next. So, what do they decide to do? Well, like their hero, Hernan Cortes, they decide to take action. Under the pretext that their lives must be in danger, they decide to travel from Phnom Penh to the royal palace that Rama is staying in. They bring 38 men, and naturally one of them is a priest, Father Aduarte, who gives them spiritual consolation for what they're going to do, and who will be able to give them confession once they do it, so no problems there. What this group is going to do is stage an assassination in the royal palace during the night. They travel to the palace, and at 2 a.m. they creep in and slaughter everyone. Guards, workers, and eventually King Rama himself. They manage to get this done and escape back to their ship in Phnom Penh without losing a single man. This is like a scene from a movie, and it sounds as exciting as it is awful. Anyway, at this point, the party splits up. Ruiz and Veloso, they decide they're going to go find their friend, King Sata, in Laos. The rest of them, they head back to the Philippines. Now, Veloso and Ruiz, in classic adventurer style, the place they need to get to, the kingdom that would become Laos, well, that's a place that literally no European has ever set foot in. But they decide they will head there and get their friend and bring him back to Cambodia because they've paved the way for him to have the throne again. They arrive in the capital of Laos, Vientiane, in the summer of 1596. Remember, this is 2 years since Lovec had originally been sacked by the Siamese. Their arrival is just what you think it might be. They are met with a procession showing off the city's immense wealth, with elephants, gold, jewels, silks, flowers, exotic snakes, and of course beautiful women, culminating with a great feast. A feast at which they learn something very important has happened. So at this point, in our story, I would be almost tempted to call this a comedy of errors if it wasn't so full of bloodshed and chauvinism. But you'll never guess who got sick and died upon his arrival in Laos almost 2 years earlier. Old King Sata, as well as one of the sons he had brought with him. So, Veloso and Ruiz, having done all this, all these crazy things, they've even killed a king and travelled to Laos, a place no one's even ever been before. They've done all this just to find out their potential benefactor has been dead the whole time. But they weren't about to give up yet. Luckily, I mean, for them, I guess, King Sata had brought two of his sons with him to Laos, and one of them was still alive, Prince Baroma Raka. Undeterred, Veloso and Ruiz bring back this prince to Phnom Penh, and they get him to take the throne. Once they get back, it is then that these two adventurers finally get what they wanted. After putting Baroma Raka on the throne, they get large provinces to control, high positions in the royal court, and naturally a number of princesses. It's the 16th century European adventurer's dream come true. That is, until the weak and disorganized prince they put on the throne is murdered in an act of revenge by a group of chairman Malay mercenaries working for the son of King Rama, the usurper who had been killed in that surprise attack by our pair of adventurers. Ruiz and Veloso rushed to help him, but they also met the same bloody fate as the prince. The reason I'm telling you this little story, which by the way ends with the Siamese just coming back a few years later and basically taking over all of Cambodia by putting that prince they had captured in the original sacking of Levesque, Prince Soriapor, they come back in, defeat the new Khmer king, and put this prince, who is now firmly pro-Siamese after being imprisoned there for about 5 years, he gets installed, and after this weird little 4 or 5 year interlude from 1594, remember that's when they first lost Levesque, the Khmer story basically then follows what we have already explained in the last episode. So, basically, nothing came of this attempt by Spain via two men to colonize Cambodia at the end of the 16th century. Except, of course, some needless bloodshed. But the reason I'm going back to tell you this story of Veloso and Ruiz is because, well, firstly, I wanted a way to introduce colonialism into this podcast with a story about Cambodia rather than Vietnam. And I had actually wanted to talk about this in the last episode, but thought it would be better holding off just so we've established our idea of pre-19th century Southeast Asia, firmly with Southeast Asian countries in history, rather than trying to introduce, you know, a whole nother continent into the story at that early point. That's kind of the practical idea about telling you this story now. But also, because it does a very good job of showing a few of the themes that come out of this period of history. Namely, that Europeans were in a sense kind of doing what they wanted during this time, but that they would also try to justify this spread of their power, killing innocent people, and taking over entire parts of the world through their religious doctrines. So with that brief kind of introduction to how colonialism looked in the 16th century, I want to leave Cambodia for a while and turn our attention back to Vietnam and events that transpired around 200 years later. Events that will introduce a new European power into this story in a century that will have long-lasting impacts upon world history. And to do that, we will pick up this story far away from Southeast Asia, in 18th century France. In northern France, a place called Origny-Saint-Benoît, a boy was born in November 1741. Pierre-Joseph-Jorge Pignot. commonly known as Pignon de Bahen, who would eventually be known as Bakda Lokbinu, a name that reflects some of the story that he would go down in history for. A fairly remarkable story that begins in an average French village and would end in Saigon, and one that would influence the shape of history with potentially far-reaching consequences for the area of the world that would be for a time known as French Indochina. I'm hoping that by retelling Pignon de Bahen's story, we will be able to explain a few things as our story progresses from the 18th century into the 19th. We will get a better handle on Vietnamese history in the era, which will be very much involved in Cambodian politics through this time period. By telling this story through the life of Pignon de Bahen, we will also get an introduction into this story for France, who will come to dominate the picture in subsequent episodes of this podcast. We will start in France, end up in Vietnam, but then hopefully have our bearings when we eventually explain how France comes back into this story toward the end of the episode. So what's going on in France around 1741 when Pierre is born? Well, kind of a lot. Historians call this the early modern period in France, and this is an era after the French Renaissance, and it coincides with an age of philosophy and enlightenment in Europe. At the time, Louis XV was the King of France, having taken the throne once his father, Louis XIV, also called Louis the Great, or the Sun King, had died. Fairly big boots to fill when your dad was the Sun King, basically one of the most powerful rulers in European history. Louis XIV had done a lot to concentrate and centralize all facets of his rule, which led to France becoming a dominant force in Europe. French kings ruled by divine right, and he was accountable only to God, not to the people. This was a period where there was a huge divide between the rich and the poor, and less than 2% of the population was made up of a privileged elite, the nobility. If you were part of that elite, this nobility, everyone else was a commoner. Now, that commoner class included merchants and business owners, and a class of the educated as well. The divide here, in this age of growing reason and philosophy, will not go unnoticed. Nor will the divine right of a king be something that will be taken for granted in the years to follow either. The mid-1700s are a complex time, and there is a growing dissatisfaction within some quarters that will eventually ferment into a little-known event called the French Revolution. But for now, let's just return to the north of France and follow along the story of Pierre de Bahen as he grows up. Pierre was not born into the nobility, but his family owned a relatively small estate and a successful tannery. Pierre will train as a missionary, and at the age of 24, it's decided he will be sent abroad by the Paris Foreign Mission Society. This Catholic institution was set up with the goal of sending missionaries to all of the new regions and countries that have opened up since those early periods of colonization began, as we discussed previously. In 1765, in a place called Lorient, Pierre is chosen as one of the missionaries to send to one of these far-off regions. He's headed to southern Vietnam, or what is known to the French as Cochin China. It would take him 2 years to arrive at the small coastal town of Ha Tien, which had been set up by missionaries from Siam who had been displaced by a Burmese invasion. Working as head of the Seminary of the Holy Angels, he encountered some hardships. He was even jailed for a few months, but ignored his family's requests to come home. A year later, after he was released from jail, his seminary is attacked by pirates, who kill many of his students and burn down the school. Pierre and the survivors escape and make their way to a place known as Viramapatnam, on the southern tip of India, in one of the few remaining areas of India that France controlled after Britain had cemented their own control over the territory. By 1769, France was in what is known as its first colonial empire phase. In the early 1600s, they had formed colonies in North America, setting up posts in what is now Canada, before claiming areas further south near the Mississippi by the end of the 17th century. From here, they spread their influence into the West Indies, and into places like Haiti, where they relied on slavery to produce crops like sugarcane. They had also set up trading posts as far away as Africa, in areas on the west like Senegal. France had actually been a little late to this party. The Spanish, the Portuguese, they'd gotten rich from milking South America of gold and silver in that first phase of colonization we talked about earlier. And it was followed by what we also touched on, that Dutch system of setting up trading networks. This spread of European powers around the globe, setting up colonies and trade and getting very rich off of this process, led to competition for these new empires to capture more and more areas to create more wealth. However, as this became more competitive and more powers were involved in this race, they eventually begin rubbing up against each other, and this in turn led to armed conflict between these powers. In fact, some historians point to a long series of wars fought between these European powers, notably France against Britain, which is known as the Seven Years' War. This could even be termed the first global war, where each continent, except Australia, which was still a few decades away from seeing a European settlement, was involved in some kind of conflict. This war, which most people say lasted longer than 7 years, is kind of like a prequel to some of the conflicts we're going to see in the 20th century, where the control of trade and the desire to increase your colonial sphere in order to produce more wealth and garner more influence becomes an important factor of international relations. In the years just prior to Pierre setting sail from France, the international stage is getting a little shaken up for the French. They had just lost this war we're talking about, the Seven Years' War. And since they had lost, well, they had to give up a bunch of territory to the British. The same year Pierre set sail, 1765, that's the year that the British imposed the Stamp Act on the American colonies, which will set in motion the gears that will produce the American Revolutionary Wars against the British. And just as a quick aside, one of the main reasons the British enact that taxation? Well, they had needed more money since they had just fought the Seven Years' War with France, and war is expensive. So it's this crazy little time where countries are figuring out how they're going to handle this new world order and keep all of their assets in these far-flung locations. When the American War for Independence from the British really gets going as well, well, the French are going to bankroll huge amounts to the Americans just as a way to hurt British colonial power. It's all very tangled, and you can see how it foreshadows the kinds of international politics and fighting that will be familiar with us still today. It also just so happens that the debt that France will accrue in helping the Americans, well, that's not going to be insignificant, and will be another influential factor in bringing on the dissatisfaction that will spur on the French Revolution that I'm going to keep just on our horizon for now. Another thing to point out about this interesting time period here, well, it's that people are talking about it. In France, this is the time where the coffee shop becomes a thing, and people are just sat about, getting all geared up on beans, grown in far off and exotic lands, and they're discussing the issues of the day. French philosophers such as Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot are able to begin really thinking out loud in this era of critical thinking, and we will see vocal criticism of Christianity, or the functions of absolute monarchy, and even the beginnings of the first encyclopedia. Meanwhile, back in French India, Pierre is recovering from his violent pirate attack by learning how to master the Chinese and Vietnamese languages until he was fluent in both. He spends a couple of years making a Vietnamese Latin dictionary with the help of some southern Vietnamese students, and while he's doing that, he is appointed Apostolic Vicar of Cochin China, which is basically like the head vicar of Cochin China. In March 1775, after having prepared in Macau, a Portuguese settlement in China, Pierre gets a team ready to head back to Ha Tien, where his former monastery was, in southern Vietnam, and he's going to re-establish that seminary that had been destroyed by pirates. Okay, so we've spoken about France and what France is doing in this era. We also need to talk about Vietnam, just to know what's going on there. You may recall from the last episode that once the Vietnamese march to the south had claimed Champa, and then after that, the bottom rump of Khmer territory in the Mekong Delta. Remember, we're calling that Kampuchea Krom. There was this period where they had claimed all of this territory, stretching down from China down to Cambodia. And after they had done this, there was a kind of split between factions in the north and factions in the newly claimed south. During this period in the 18th century, Vietnam was nominally under the rule of the officially revered, but in reality politically powerless, Le dynasty. The actual power was in those northern and southern feudal families, the Trinh lords in the north, ruling from Hanoi, and the Nguyen lords in the south, who ruled from their capital in Hue. There were periods of fighting and periods of relative peace between the north and the south, and general war between the two feudal families had stopped for many decades at this point. The situation didn't stay like that, however, and this was due in part because the Nguyen lords in the south would continually invade Khmer territory, even to the extent of fighting wars through Cambodia aimed at the Siamese. In order to fund these wars, heavy taxation, as well as the need for armed men, would eventually lead to a general dissatisfaction in the southern populace about the Nguyen lords' continued rule. This dissatisfaction would culminate in 1769, when the King of Siam, Thaksin, would launch a war to retake control of Cambodia, and in doing so, wrestle control of Khmer territories away from Nguyen influence. The war went against the Nguyen lords, and the loss of this territory, as well as the heavy taxes levied to pay for the fighting, this led three brothers from a village called Thay Son to lead a revolt against their local Nguyen lord, Phuc Thuan. Over the next 7 years, these brothers would gain more and more momentum in their rebellion. They styled themselves as champions of the people, and gained enough support to seriously contend that they might defeat both the Nguyen lords in the south, and then go on to claim the north from the Trinh lords, and unite Vietnam, and remove corrupt officials, and end the oppression of the people. The three brothers will eventually command a strong army, and will refashion this army as the Thay Son Rebellion, and lead a massive attack against the Nguyen lord's capital of Hue, forcing the family there to flee to Saigon. Eventually, the Thay Son brothers will also reach this city, and in 1776 they will besiege and massacre the Nguyen lord family and proclaim themselves rulers of the south. And after this, they would turn their attention to the north, and having amassed a very powerful army, they will pursue the unpopular Trinh lords and quickly take control of the north of Vietnam as well. The thing is, though, they had failed to kill all of the Nguyen lords in the south. One had survived, a 15-year-old prince named Nguyen Phuc An. He managed to escape the siege and the slaughter and travel southeast to the coast to a town named Ha Tien, and it is there that the prince who was being pursued by the Thay Son brothers will be sheltered and fed by a French Catholic priest named Pierre. After 2 months of hiding, the last surviving Nguyen lord prince, the French Catholic missionary, will end up taking quite a fateful career move toward politics, as he and Nguyen An both flee to an island in the Gulf of Siam. This is quite the pivot for the missionary. For the next 22 years, the heir to the Nguyen Lord throne will be accompanied by Pierre as he attempts to reclaim southern Vietnam and eventually the entirety of the country. Pierre goes from writing essays about Catholic doctrine to smuggling grenades to a pro-southern Vietnamese revolt in Cambodia that seeks to dethrone a pro-Siamese king there. In 1787, Pierre even heads to the court of the last king of the French monarchy, Louis XVI, and tries to get assistance in helping Nguyen An to the throne. Similar to what Diego Veloso had done in Manila, except France and the French court is in an extremely poor financial position at this time. Like, this is just before the French Revolution begins. On this diplomatic mission, he even brings the 7-year-old son of Nguyen An to Versailles, and the boy causes quite a stir. He even leads one of the most famous hairdressers of the time, Léonard, to create a hairstyle in his honour called, and I'm not going to try and say it in French because it's too hard, but in English it's the Prince from Cochin China. The young prince, he's also spending time playing with the Dauphin of France, who was around the same age as him. By November, the missionary turned solicitor of wars, pestering of the French court, would finally prove effective, and the Treaty of Versailles is concluded between France and Cochin China in Nguyen An's name. 4 frigates and more than 1,500 French soldiers were promised in the treaty, and in return, France would get exclusive trading rights, some islands off the coast, as well as a port in Da Nang. The document was signed by Pierre, and it is interesting to note that he signs it with the title Pinyao de Bahain, like Pinyao of Bahain, which is kind of a way of making it sound like you are of the nobility. But this was just kind of a trick that many people were trying in this period in France, and it was kind of seen as a bit tacky. But it certainly signals the kind of space the former missionary was now playing in, rather than his slightly less glamorous days preaching in Hà Tiên and being chased around by pirates. So, once the deal is signed, Pierre thinks he has what he needs here. Except he doesn't. Basically, the French king isn't totally convinced by this whole thing. Not to mention being totally broke. So he tells the governor of French India, a guy named Thomas Conway, a man with his own very interesting story, worth looking into if you have the time. Louis XVI tells this guy, Conway, he basically says, look, I don't know about this whole Cochin China thing. I basically signed the treaty to get these guys out of my house. They're heading to you now. I'm going to leave it up to you whether this is a good idea. And basically, you can decide to do it or not, whatever you think, Conway. So when the governor of French India receives this party, he deigns not to really help out. He sends them on their way to Vietnam with just 1,000 muskets and thinks that's about enough. From here, well, Pinyao is forced to basically do it himself. He raises money from French merchants in the region and enlists French volunteers and mercenaries. He gets a couple of ships together and he sets off for Vietnam in 1789. There, this group of military advisors is able to modernize the southern Vietnamese army, its navy, and fortifications. Modern uses of artillery, European infantry methods, these are all implemented, and over the next 4 years, these technologies and techniques are used to start winning the war for the Nguyen prince. From 1794 onwards, the missionary turned diplomat is now fully engaged in these battles. He even organizes the defense of a citadel in Saigon after it had been overrun by the enemy. Once Nguyen An had taken over the south of Vietnam, he would spend years gradually consolidating power northward. After he had built this modern navy with the help of his French officers, of which up to maybe 200 or 400 French soldiers will also be in these armed forces, in his army. Basically, this modern army will take advantage of various weaknesses, and over about 10 years, they will one by one defeat those Taizong brothers who had taken control of the regions of Vietnam. After almost 10 years of fighting with the prince in Vietnam, Pierre de Bahane would not even survive to see the prince he had helped back into Vietnam end up on the throne. He will die at the port of Quy Nhon from dysentery. He's buried in Saigon with full military honours, in the presence of the crown prince, 12,000 royal bodyguards, and 40,000 mourners. Not long after this funeral, the son of Nguyen An, remember the young prince that had accompanied De Bahane to France, he would also die of illness. And this is an important moment because the case could be made that the priest had paid special attention in trying to persuade and convert the young prince to Catholicism. Apparently this wasn't too far from being accomplished either, as the prince would draw crosses on statues of Buddha and even refuse to kneel at the altar of his ancestors. In some accounts, he desperately wanted to be baptized, but Pierre had thought it would basically upset everyone too much, especially his father. I'm going to return to this point in a moment, but let's just plant a flag there for now, because the implications of what the priest had perhaps been trying to do all along, which could be seen as trying to set up the next emperor of Vietnam as a Catholic, therefore opening up the country to Catholic influence, well, that's going to have some interesting consequences. But for now, let's finish up with Nguyen An's quest to unify Vietnam. So, in 1801, the prince would be able to retake the former Nguyen Lord capital of southern Vietnam, Hue. And after this, he felt he was in a strong enough position going forward to proclaim himself emperor in the former capital and decide to rule under the name Emperor Gia Long, which was symbolic, a little bit of language that symbolizes the merging of north and south. He would go on to capture the last Taizong stronghold in the northern capital of Hanoi in 1802, and in doing so would reunite Vietnam after about a century of civil war and strife. He controlled territory all the way from China down into the Gulf of Siam, and because the French had not honored the treaty they had signed back in Versailles, he was not required to cede any territory to the European power. However, several of the Frenchmen who had assisted the prince would remain in high positions in the new emperor's court, and although Gia Long was quite strident in his Confucian orthodoxy, he did have a tolerance of Catholicism in the newly united Vietnam. So the situation in 1802 looked very good for Gia Long. He had consolidated power over the entirety of Vietnam and was now in possession of a technically and tactically advanced navy and armed military. As we said earlier, he did impose a fairly strict Confucian orthodoxy over his new country, but he felt obliged to show some deference to those French who had helped him gain power, so Catholic missionaries were tolerated, but not fully supported. Now that his rule was undisputed in Vietnam, and the strength of a unified Vietnam was growing, I want to turn our attention to the political situation in Cambodia during this era, because over the next 40 years or so, Vietnam will practically take complete control over Cambodia in a manner that will differ from the Siamese style of running Cambodia. And this will begin to set up the next chapter of this story, when the French arrive in about 50 years, with the intention to fully colonize the region. Okay, so the Siamese, they had been overseeing the politics in Cambodia heading into the time that Gia Long became emperor in Vietnam. They had installed a king named Eng on the throne in 1794. Up until that point, Cambodia was sort of without a genuine ruler, you know, which reflects the aimlessness of the politics in that country during this period. The Thai had even given a warlord known as Bayan a few districts of Khmer territory, it's actually the ones containing Angkor, to reward him for some of the fighting he had done against the Thay Son brothers, who had also come into Cambodia for a while and fought with the Siamese. So just to go over that again, the Thai installed a pro-Thai leader in Cambodia in 1794, but at the same time, they gave some territory, which really wasn't theirs to give, to another warlord who governed this area in between Siam and Cambodia. As you can probably imagine, a foreign power literally giving away some of your most treasured land and landmarks to some guy as a present would not really enamor that native population to you. And it's during this period that the pendulum of Cambodian politics that seems to always be going from one side of Indochina to the other is swung in motion once again toward the Vietnamese side. Because the Khmer, well, they're pretty salty toward the Thai for giving away this piece of land to someone who's not even the ruler of their country. So you've got Aang ruling Cambodia, whose disposition is towards Siam. And you've got a kind of independent area between the two countries that isn't really ruled by Siam or the Khmer. This isn't hugely important for now, but it will be a bit later, so just put a pin in that for me, please. Now, just after Gia Long becomes emperor in Vietnam, the Khmer king set up by Thailand, Aang, he dies. And his throne is taken by his son, Prince Chan, who follows in the time-honored tradition of switching allegiance from Siam to Vietnam and turns toward the now unified Vietnamese state under Gia Long, and he looks for protection and offers tributes to the new emperor. To really seal the deal, Prince Chan ignores the funeral of the Siamese king, and when a couple of members of his royal court show signs of being pro-Thai, well, he has them killed. I'm going to give you a brief rundown of what happens next, but in the next episode, when we discuss Vietnam's control over Cambodia and the coming of the French, we will revisit this period, so if you're not completely on top of it now, don't worry. However, that being said, let's just finish up this episode with how Cambodia does fall into the sphere of Vietnamese influence. So, like I said, Prince Chan, he's looking towards Vietnam now for help, rather than Thailand. And this actually leads to a brief war between Cambodia and Siam. And what does Prince Chan do? He calls on the Vietnamese for help. They come to his aid, but this reliance on Vietnam will now put Cambodia into more and more of a political dependency on their eastern neighbor. What that dependent relationship will actually function as and look like is basically just the Vietnamese and Emperor Gia Long controlling more aspects of Khmer territory and politics and their economy. For instance, it's under Gia Long that the construction of the Van Tay Canal is begun. This was a huge project that was dug along the Vietnam-Cambodia border down toward the sea and relied on tens of thousands of labourers to construct. The local Khmer that were used as labour here were treated, by all accounts, quite badly, and thousands died as a result of overwork and disease. This is where the story of the Master's Tea comes from, the one we spoke about in the last episode, that will eventually come to be a kind of iconic folktale that symbolizes Vietnamese mistreatment of Khmer and is still popular there today. Again, it's just that, a folktale. But the image of the Cambodian prisoners buried up to their necks and being patronizingly told not to move about too much as their heads were used to boil a kettle of water, this kind of imagery does a lot of work in metaphorically showing what this relationship between the Vietnamese and Khmer was becoming in this period, and sums up what many would have seen as a huge amount of suffering imposed from the Vietnamese. Work on the canal began in 1819, 1 year before Emperor Jialong would die. And this led his son, Emperor Min Mang, upon getting the throne, to continue its construction, as well as continue Vietnam's increasing presence in Cambodia, to the point of turning it into a state almost completely administered by Vietnam and positioned towards serving Vietnamese interests. This is where we're going to begin ending this episode, with Jialong dead, but his son taking over in Vietnam and taking over Cambodia in what will become a decades-long period where Cambodia essentially loses the status of an independent state. And it is now that I want to briefly return to the story of the young son of the prince, the one who had traveled to Versailles with Pignol de Bahane and became enamored toward Catholicism. As I said before, he died before Jialong became emperor, and this meant that any plans that De Bahane might have had for a future Vietnamese state ruled by a Catholic emperor also died with that prince. Ironically, Min Mang, the son who did end up becoming emperor, was staunchly anti-Catholic and would not be constrained by a relationship with the French or with any French priests that might have produced the reluctancy his father had when it came to outlawing what he thought was an insidious and dangerous foreign influence. This decision will also have the effect of drawing a new France, one that has risen once more after the French Revolution. This new France will not see this mistreatment of Catholics in Vietnam as acceptable, and this will lead to a war between France and Vietnam. And that's a war that could only end one way. As we leave this story for now, in the 1820s, having learned of two failed attempts by Europeans to colonize this region, whether by force or through more subtle spiritual means, we are arriving close to the world order that will bring in the 20th century. And this region of the world would soon enough be known as French Indochina. The events that usher in this era will be the focus of the next episode of In the Shadows of Utopia. I realize this episode has run a little longer than usual, so thank you for getting this far and listening. If you'd like to visit the website, please visit www.shadowsofutopia.com, where you can find more information about the podcast and even get in contact. Now, we are finally moving into the era that will literally precede the Cambodian nightmare of the 1970s. So, thank you for listening this far, and keep a lookout for the next episode.